Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers who are shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. On our program today, how the 67 billion rand steel tariff review could shape the future of the industry. A new global chief executive survey shows sub-Saharan leaders are showing climate change foresight. Government's U-turn on its cannabis foodstuffs ban, the retail view, and yet another call for youth development to be at the center of future business. Of course, we know this. The question is, lip service being paid to this issue? It's Thursday, the 27th of March. Now, South Africa, you might have read, is in the middle of a high-stakes 67 billion rand steel tariff review with the ITAC, that's the International Trade Administration Commission, reassessing duties that could shape the future of the country's industrial competitiveness. So on the one hand, local steel producers like ArcelorMittal South Africa are lobbying for continued protection. You know what sort of difficulty the company is in. On the other side, downstream industries like construction, mining, manufacturing, I guess, say duties are driving up costs. That's killing jobs and forcing them to import at a loss. At the center of this very complex balancing act is Aya Bonga Qawe, who is ITAC commissioner. And I guess the big question is, can South Africa afford protectionist policies in a globalized, cost-sensitive economy? So, Commissioner, very warm welcome and thanks very much for joining us. How does one then justify duties when even our largest steel user, Transnet, is importing to reduce costs?
Good afternoon to you, Jeremy, and thank you so much for having us. I think the question you pose is probably one of the many questions in the complicated web of what we do as a small open market economy that has had historically some capability to make a wide range of steel products across the entire value chain in a global context where there's structural overcapacity of steel. It doesn't only introduce challenges and vulnerabilities to the sector itself, but even to some of the downstream customers and users of the product, including Transnet that you mentioned. And part of our cruel irony that we might have, Jeremy, to your point, is that you have a Transnet that would, for many reasons that might be known to Transnet, would import certain sections of steel or rail components at a time when some of the domestic capability we have to produce a rail product in what is now Mpumalanga, many of those facilities are operating at chronically low levels of capacity utilization. And so this is part of the challenge that we have, which is that you're not going to resolve the challenge of the steel sector only by dealing with tariffs, but tariffs have to be part of the discussion, precisely because you do have a situation, one, of a chronic and global structural overcapacity challenge. There's much more steel that we are capable as the world to produce than at this stage the world can absorb in many applications downstream, be it construction, automotive sector, and many other downstream applications of steel. So we've seen per capita consumption of steel growing much slower over the last two decades than the installed capacity and capital stock to produce steel that we've seen in places like China and India. And so you can't not consider tariffs. They have to be on the table precisely because as protectionism advances in other parts of the world, economies like South Africa might remain as the few kind of top 20 steel importing nations that will still be open to a kind of, the deviation of some of those imports that would have been destined for the protected markets might potentially come here and displace our own capabilities at a time of deep crisis, as you say. And our view has been that the AMSA crisis is a constituent part of a broader national crisis in steel. This overcapacity I'm talking about, Jeremy, is also evident in South Africa across many profiles and grades of steel product as well.
I guess it all comes down to the scale of tariff, because there's the argument that tariffs can prop up inefficiencies at companies like ArcelorMittal South Africa, for instance, at the expense of job creation downstream. So you've got to find that sweet spot, which is perhaps more difficult than one thinks.
Well, there's a balance. Our kind of policy disposition has always been that we are not pursuing autarky here, which is kind of creating a tariff wall around our own market. But we manage customs duty amendments in a way that doesn't numb the competitive impulse of firms to innovate, to improve their productivity and be able to compete in the market. And our observation of the steel tariff regime in line with the Uruguay round in the 1990s is that steel is one of the areas where we've got bounded tariffs. You have a ceiling to the extent which you can increase your tariffs. And I think in this notice, we've also shared with the public, here are all of the Chapter 72, Chapter 73, Chapter 82 and 83 products. Here's where the current tariffs are. Here's what those bound rates might be. And it's quite clear that across many categories of steel, you do have, in some cases, tariffs that are 10% where the bound rate is 15%. Implied in that, you have 5% of policy wiggle room to be able either to increase tariffs, but also part of the discussion, Jeremy, is not just about increasing tariffs. There's also a discussion about, do your rebate measures in Schedule 4 of the Customs and Excise Act, which allow for the duty-free importation of certain intermediate input products in the steel market, are those calibrated correctly? Are those being subject to abuse? Are those a basis for circumvention of other protective measures? And so this review is not just about a very hawkish attempt to raise tariffs across the board, but a much more balanced reading of where we might have to raise tariffs, but also in other instances where we might have to complement our existing rebate provision, which would effectively reduce the tariff burden or the duty liability of firms that need imported inputs in order to make other downstream steel products. It's kind of a bit of a, how do I put it, the dance of a regulator, that you're not only moving in one direction, but recognizing our own, the peculiarities of our own industrial profile, recognizing the interests of all stakeholders in the steel value chain, both at the primary level, which is your point on AMSA, but there are many other producers downstream who might have a different interest than just getting tariffs raised across the board. They might be interested in reducing their duty liability on their input material.
Is it time to ask the question as to whether the steel sector is truly strategic, as has been pushed forward before? Is this simply not trying to save a declining industry with old thinking?
Well, I think we have to debate what accounts for the decline. And I think there are many kind of assertions that are out there in the public, which I won't get into in any detail. But if you arrive at a certain perspective about what has accounted for the decline, you might also think through about how we might, at a policy level, respond. But the bigger existential question you're asking is, should this be an industry that we, at a national level, back, be it by foregone tax revenue or even putting some protective cover that raises costs across the economy? Our considered view, just by the breadth and extent of downstream use of steel, is that this is a strategic sector. You cannot have an automotive sector integrated into global value chains, much like the one South Africa has, without access to upstream intermediate inputs of steel, both primary grades of a flat and even a long product nature. Similarly, our own aerospace, defense, and manufacturing capability is heavily reliant on different specialty grades of steel that are produced in the country. And I could go even further if I take a look at the extent of use of structural and other steel products in construction, that suggest that in a polarized and increasingly partitioned multilateral trading system, you would be visiting an inordinate amount of risk, vulnerability, that you would have to respond to if you were to give up on having some capability to fabricate steel domestically. We've seen during COVID, we've seen during the supply chain challenges associated with the conflict in Eastern Europe, the moment you've got that type of geopolitical situation, it affects the multilateral trading system in very particular ways, raises lead times. But I think in our case, begins to place the entire industrial destiny of the country in the hands of people who might not necessarily have the same interests that South Africa Inc. might have.
And I'm going to leave it there with my thanks and appreciation. That's Ayabonga Xawe, who is Commissioner at the International Trade Administration Commission. Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the climate crisis is no longer just looming. It really is here. But amidst the global uncertainty, a new PwC CEO survey reveals a refreshing trend, I think it's fair to say. Sub-Saharan African business leaders are showing what's termed strategic foresight by starting to embed sustainability into their heart of operations. From agriculture to infrastructure, the stakes are high. So what does this real climate leadership now look like in what is still a financially constrained environment? I'm in conversation now with Matt Miller from PwC, and we're going to try and break down some of the numbers and perhaps the mindset as well behind what I would see possibly as a green pivot. So Matt, 78%, and a warm welcome to you, of CEOs say they've made climate-friendly investments. All well and good, but how many are doing so realistically and beyond just public relations optics?
It's a great question. And so one of the other ways we look at how they're actually taking action instead of just saying that they're doing this is we look at how this is linked to their incentive and remuneration structures. And in this instance, what we've seen is that there's about 7 out of 10 of the CEOs that have responded to our survey have then said that they do actually have KPIs that are linked to climate related investment. So this is obviously a key mechanism for us to ensure that businesses are actually acting on what they're saying and doing, because that's where, you know, it's putting your money where your mouth is. So I think from that perspective, it gives us a bit of comfort that there is actually action in terms of the space.
So Matt, what type of action then are we seeing? What sort of decisions are being made that give credence to their optimism?
Yes. So where we're seeing this is in sort of a maturity scale. It's a little bit on the easy to address stuff at this point in time, because it's where we can identify direct links to business value. So if we take South Africa, for example, you know, load shedding last year, the year before, big impacts in terms of companies' financials and how they operate and business continuity. So we saw a big push towards installing solar through incentives that also encourage this. And this is really where we've been saying to business for a long time is that where you can start to understand the link to your impact on the environment, often that has an impact on your bottom line as well. So reducing your diesel use or electricity use through installation of solar systems or renewable electricity systems, for example, in the end, while there's a big capital outlay, can in the long run affect your OPEX and that consideration. So that's where we've seen a lot of traction at this point in time.
But to that point, though, if I've read the survey correctly, half of the chief executives report no impact on real costs. So again, I think one's got to ask if the investment is negligible or if the benefits are being overstated.
It's a good question. And what we have interpreted this are saying is that there are other investments that are being made in the space, and there's potentially less direct, it's harder to measure the direct benefits, and that's why they're saying limited to no impact on their costs. So this is examples where you have a happier workforce who, for example, you know, they're proud of the company for taking action in this space. It's an indirect cost or a benefit in terms of retention and staff, that you've seen people staying for longer. You don't have the high rates of turnover. That's one small example, but we do also see it playing out in terms of, you know, just better work environments, healthier living. If you don't have these diesel generators spewing out, you know, harmful emissions, it means people don't feel as impacted by that in the workplace as well.
Would I be correct in saying that government in this respect has been shunted to the margin? 70% of those surveyed say any incentive offered by government barely matters.
So this is something that we've been talking about for a while, is that in the climate space, from an incentives perspective, there's been very limited incentives that have been provided. Last year, as I said, in South Africa, there were for the last 2 years, from a business perspective, there were the solar incentives, which now ended in February this year. But aside from that, there haven't really been real incentives from the government side for businesses to act. There's been the more tax-based approach, so in terms of the carbon tax, which has been driving a bit of the push in terms of this. But from an incentives perspective, we would obviously like to see more in the space that actually encourages business. And I do believe that we've been doing a bit of modeling on the side that starts to suggest that the tax incentive that was provided, while businesses were moving because of a business continuity need in terms of keeping the lights on, that incentive definitely did play a role in actually moving businesses in the right direction as well.
Let me just ask you a final question. All of this is very positive, but I wonder to myself if there's a risk that climate friendly, as has been illustrated by the survey, almost becomes the new greenwashing in sub-Saharan boardrooms. That it's all very well in this place and time right now to have this positive news, but unless the momentum is sustained, we're just going to slip back further on the scale.
Yeah, and it's spot on. And we've seen a big pushback against any sort of greenwashing, and it's something we're very conscious about. The consideration here is that really we want to make sure that this is linked to business value. It can't just be a nice to have. It's a positive marketing message, but if that is all that it is, it's not achieving what we actually believe is the real benefit to business, and that you see genuine business continuity. As I say, it keeps the lights on. It reduces operating expenses over time. So really, I think if companies are not understanding that, that's really where we see a challenge. And that, I agree with you, if that's, you're not taking that leg, then that is going to be a challenge.
Matt Muller from PwC, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's a classic South African policy stumble. First the ban, then the backlash, now the backtrack. After a wave of public outrage, government has reversed its decision to ban cannabis-infused food products. But while the regulators are scrambling, entrepreneurs have been holding the line. And in that respect, I want to talk to Vanessa Jarvis-Findlay, founder of Naked Cannabis Cafe, to unpack what all of this means for the business of cannabis and maybe pushing into the future where the real growth lies. So Vanessa, a very warm welcome, and maybe a good starting point for us is to take us inside your business. How did this proposed ban initially reflect on your business when you heard about it?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for the opportunity. I always love the platform to speak about this wonderful medicine. So me personally, when we received the news, it didn't really affect me too much because as one of South Africa's very first cannabis cafes, already I'm operating in the grey. So I adopted international standards, which is responsible adult use. And that is that you have to prove that you're over the age of 18 to be able to purchase medicine from me, and also that you have had a consultation with one of my qualified cannabis consultants so that we're having the right dosage, etc. When the news came in, I was a little bit shook because I thought, oh my goodness, we've taken a few steps back again. However, to be quite frank, I didn't take the product off the shelves because I had so many customers phoning me, stressing out that they weren't going to have their medicine, stressing out what they're going to do for their pain, what are they going to do for X, Y, Z. And I just, as a cannabis activist myself, I decided to just continue operating the way I am to international standards, and that's with the responsible adult use protocol.
Vanessa, do you think there was a misunderstanding then by government as to exactly what cannabis cafes are doing?
You know, Jeremy, for me, there's two stories to this, because first of all, let's just understand something. Alcohol is linked to over 3 million deaths globally each year. Tobacco kills more than 8 million people annually. Cannabis, fewer than 100 direct deaths per year globally. And most of those are contested or they involve pre-existing conditions or mixed substances. So why is there this disproportionate crackdown on cannabis? And why so little regulation around like bottle stores and liquor adverts and cigarette sales? While cannabis cafes, wellness products and medicinal access are restricted, criminalized and often vilified even. It's not about public health, Jeremy. I believe this is about protecting revenue. And you know, we've got big players. We've got the pharma factor, we've got tobacco factor industry, and we've got the alcohol industry. And I think they are influencing our government.
What did your customers say to you, Vanessa? Did they must have felt alarmed as well, yeah.
They were stressed. Literally, the phones did not stop ringing. We had inundated with calls. Look, I mean, thank you so much. I had a great week at the last 10 days. Business has been fantastic because there's panic buying. However, we are doing our very best. We are writing blogs. We inform. We always educate our members. Everybody needs to sign up to become a member of our private social club. And we educate them as much as we provide really good medicine. And we've just been keeping them abreast of what has been going on. And also, I have been quite adamant that I will continue to stand and sell my products in my store under adult responsible adult use protocol.
What do you think this kind of regulatory flip-flop does, though, to what is obviously a growing retail sector and you're trying to build trust and consistency?
This is not good for any industry. I doubt that any other industry would be so pushed around and bullied like we are. Literally, this is my next call to action, is that we've got to remove it. Remove cannabis from... some of the laws are so outdated. Some of the laws are still saying that it's illegal. So we need to remove some of these laws. We've really got to unpack everything again. We need to have transparent conversations. This is what's also happening. We can't just have the big players behind closed doors discussing our industry. And I understand that we are a threat. We are a huge threat to the other industries because we are providing, there's a natural user-driven alternative and it's low cost. So with more people choosing cannabis over opioids, sleeping pills, anti-inflammatories, antidepressants, Big Pharma understandably is rattled. Tobacco, kids aren't smoking cigarettes anymore. They'd rather have a joint or they'd have a THC vape pen. So, you know, you mentioned that you're a baby boomer. But some of our oldest customers are in their 80s and 90s, and that's been so huge for us to change stigma there and propaganda and the misinformation that they've received. But I think sometimes people have an issue with cannabis until their life depends on it. I'm a cancer survivor. I'm here today because of cannabis. So, and I've seen how many thousands of patients and customers I've helped and what the plant can do. So for me, it's our, you know, we've got a constitutional right to privacy, which is check why we have the private social cannabis club. And then also we have a right to heal ourselves with whatever we choose, with any natural substance that we choose. So there's lots of things that need to be put onto the table to be discussed, Jeremy. I'm so happy that these conversations have been opened and started now. But now it's time for all the entrepreneurs to get together, all the chefs, all the sangomas, the traditional hearers, the growers, the patients. Let's form these councils that, you know, like for instance, the liquor board governs the liquor stores. We need a cannabis board that can also come out and check that all of our, these dispensaries like mine are actually dispensing the correct medicine that's clearly marked, it's got the right dosage in. I mean, and I understand why the health minister got scared, because if there's also a terrible culture at the moment of tricking people into having an edible. So because they look like sweets, so for instance, we often hear it in our shop, people come in and say, oh, please, can I have a sweetie? I want to give it to my mom, or I want to give it to my husband, or I want to give it to my... And I want to give it to my child,
I think is the concern, because the health minister is saying that he gazetted these regulations because he wanted to protect children who ate them, whether accidentally or intentionally. Does he have a point?
I totally agree with him. This is why I feel that we need to regulate this industry and we need to have a governing board like the liquor board does, et cetera, et cetera. Because we need to, because not everybody is conscious as what I am. I'm a conscious entrepreneur. This medicine has saved my life and kept my family alive as well. So this is so personal for me. So for me, I am adamant. And also I personally can't consume edibles. I can smoke, but I can't consume them. It gives me a bit of psychosis. I don't want to have psychosis. So can you imagine somebody that doesn't even know what they've taken, Jeremy, now they take an accidental sweetie and 2 hours later they feel like they are losing their minds because they don't know what to expect.
Vanessa, when you talk about pressure being put on government, you referenced Big Pharma and the alcohol industry. Is that anecdotal or do you have proof that that is actually happening?
You know, it's starting to, and more and more evidence is starting to reveal itself. I mean, who's funding all these anti-cannabis campaigns? Who funds the police forces, the million or the 2 million they need to come and crack down on cannabis cafes? Who's funding all of this? Our government doesn't have the allocation for these funds for our police force. You know, but you've got to start asking these questions. And I don't even think it's myself that's saying this. If you speak to anybody, Big Pharma, it's not in their best interest. You know, cannabis was always our medicine, Jeremy. It's only in the last 90 years that it's been vilified, demonized, the propaganda around it. This is so that Big Pharma could step in. And never, ever have we, as human beings, been sicker in the last 90 years because of Big Pharma.
Vanessa, I'm going to leave it there, yeah. But the debate is certainly flying once again. That's Vanessa Jarvis-Findlay, founder of Naked Cannabis Cafe. I appreciate your time and your honesty today. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, with the youngest population in the world, Africa's real growth engine isn't minerals or markets, it's young people. I think we've heard that before, but here's the problem. Talent can't bloom in tough soil, they say. So malnutrition, poor education, and a general lack of leadership opportunities are all stalling the continent's future. So I'm assuming that accelerated corporate intervention in one way or another is critical. And I want to talk now about something called the Boxer Youth Leadership Program. It comes from the giant Danone group. It's just begun. I want to ask if youth empowerment is finally getting the serious attention that it needs, or are we still paying lip service to the continent's biggest asset? From Danone, I'm joined now by Leanne Keyser, and I want to discuss this in a little more detail. So Leanne, a very warm welcome to you. 2025, why are we still battling with something like basic youth nutrition?
Youth nutrition, youth unemployment actually remains a persistent issue in South Africa and something that needs to be addressed. You know, if we first of all look at the landscape of unemployment, particularly in youth, what we see today is that more than half of youth in South Africa remain unemployed. And one of the major gaps there is the lack of skills in this community of people. And indeed, you know, developing skills among youth is going to be critical to shaping the future of South Africa. So on one hand, we have this aspect of having to enhance skills and provide education for that upskilling. And the other element, as you've pointed out, is the topic of malnutrition and making sure that these youth have the right nutrition to be able to fulfill and fuel their learning potential and their growth potential. Today, we see actually dire stats on this. Still, only around one quarter of South Africa's children are receiving the minimum diet in diversity and sort of nutrition quality to fulfill what's recommended by dietary recommendations. And so 3/4 of children then, as a result, are not meeting their full potential in terms of growth, in terms of mental development. And yes, I think more and more light is shining on the issue. We're seeing movement from government. We're seeing movement from the African Union to really highlight the youth as an important and sensitive target audience to be able to deliver interventions to close these upskilling and nutrition gaps. But certainly corporate can jump in and get involved and help to accelerate the work.
And one's got to ask the key question, and we're going to talk about the youth program that you run in just a moment. But the key question is, the private sector often, as I mentioned, pays lip service to this, but doesn't really follow through.
I don't see that to be true, certainly in the spaces that we are working in and certainly the partnerships that we've built. I mean, you know, remember that in order for a business to be thriving in South Africa, we need to be operating in an environment of healthy, economically active, busy, well South Africans. You know, in the end, if we are operating in a community of South Africans which are working, employed, active, and healthy, this ultimately will serve economy, and this will ultimately serve brands and industries to thrive. So we don't view the topic in isolation. We don't view it as, you know, a CSI initiative, you know, strictly a social initiative. It is a social initiative, but we also see it as a seeding or investment back into the development and economical growth of South Africa, which ultimately will feed back into businesses, and together we can thrive. So it's really a dual purpose principle. And certainly from Danone's perspective, that's how we see it. And the likes of Boxer, who you've mentioned, we've partnered with in our youth development program. We believe that they see it the same way.
So what do you think sets this Boxer youth program apart from dozens of others that would claim the same impact?
Our impact is substantial. You know, so just to give you some background on the program and what it looks like, first of all, it's in its 23rd year of implementation. This makes it really special already. You know, it's not the kind of program which is fly by night or inconsistent. There has been a consistent delivery, delivering this sustainable impact for children across South Africa and Eswatini over 23 years. And so the idea, you know, what the program does is that it identifies kids in high school from under-resourced backgrounds, and it hosts them at a five-day leadership camp on an annual basis. And at this leadership camp, I mean, frankly, the kids are exposed to topics and environments that they've never seen before. You know, for many of them, they've never even been on an airplane for the first time. They've never seen the beach for the first time. And the program obviously exposes them to those elements. Mm. There's a lot of adventure skills as part of the program, which help to teach kids that even if they're afraid of something, they have the ability to overcome it. You know, I can do hard things. I can overcome hard things that I might be fearful of. And in between these soft skills that we're teaching, there's also things like problem solving, the ability to confront challenges, the ability for team building, helping kids identify their aspirations and passion points, conflict resolution, career exposure, and then ultimately, Danon's input into the program is this topic of how do you fuel your potential through the right nutrition?
So fair enough. So let me ask you in conclusion, there's no doubt that your heart is in the right place here, but critical that business plays a continuing role in youth development beyond a 1 or 2 week training event such as you've outlined.
Absolutely. I believe that it is a mandate. You know, it really is a mandate. It must be a consistent strategic point as part of our business goals that we continue to upskill and invest in our communities and youth around it. I fully am aligned with that principle. And we see the impact. You know, many of these kids ultimately get employed back into the system. There's beautiful case studies, which I'll share another day of alumni, graduates of the Youth Leadership Program who actually get employed back into the Boxer retail service, and other alumni who have done really impactful, fantastic things. So we see the impact. We see the benefit of the work we're doing.
Leanne Keyser, thank you very much indeed from Danon. I appreciate your time today. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We're back tomorrow live at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.